Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. My name is Ashim Singh. I'm director of the RSA's research programme on the economy, enterprise and manufacturing, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all here today for today's special event. Now, it's a real privilege to be in the chair today, as it's the opening event of the RSA 2019 calendar, and I think we're getting off to a cracking start with our first guest of this year. Anand Giridharadas is a political analyst for NBC News, having been a foreign correspondent and columnist for the New York Times for many years. He is the author of The True American and India Calling, and he joins us today to talk about his new book, a New York Times best-selling book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, which I think it's fair to say has caused a bit of a sensation in change-making circles. The book tells the story of Anand's journey from insider to truth-teller, of how, having worked as a McKinsey analyst and as an Aspen Institute fellow, he began to feel like an accomplice to the actions of a global elite who are actually hijacking the very meaning of social change. So if you could join me in giving Anand a round of applause.
So I feel you guys do you do intimidating rooms well in this country. I mean, if this country is good at anything, it is intimidating rooms. I just sat in a chair that I was not supposed to sit on that was for Prince Philip and had a sign saying, do not sit in Prince Philip's chair. So I just did that also. So that was great. After watching The Crown, I felt no compunction about
it. Well, there you have it. So the way we're going to do this today is Anand and I are going to have a bit of a conversation about his book, about some of the ideas behind the book. Then what we'll do is we'll open it out to questions thereafter. So perhaps, Anand, if I could kick off by asking you to tell us a little bit about the time that you found yourself on a stage at Aspen in 2015, about to tell a room full of rich and powerful people, including many of your own friends and colleagues, that they weren't necessarily the saviors that they think they were?
I'm a writer, and I've been a writer for a while, and I had been a writer for a while at that moment. And as some kind of cosmic accident that I'm sure the Aspen Institute has never repeated, they have this fellowship called the Henry Crown Fellowship, and its real purpose is to kind of civilize business people. That's the idea they use. So they take mid-career young leaders, business people, they now have replicas of this fellowship in other countries, who are kind of focused on business success, and they intervene in their late 30s or 40s to try to help them see social problems, the larger needs of the world, and to try to make them read Plato and Gandhi. We also read Jack Welch, which should have been a warning sign, and to try to kind of deploy them, to educate them in these larger social issues, to work on these big problems. But in a class of 20 business people alone deliberating may be a little boring. So into every class of 20 or so people, they throw in an artist, a writer. I'm not sure if they still do this, but they did. And I was one of these kind of side people. And so I've been in this fellowship a few years. And at first it was great and really fun. And Aspen, if you've been there, is one of the loveliest places on earth. And it's very easy to feel like you're on this gorgeous mountain and this gorgeous chalet, and you really are making the world a better place just by being there. And I began to have misgivings about the place, which led to giving that speech. And the misgivings were, I think, at the heart of what the book became about years later, which is that it seemed to me, first of all, the period of my being in that place in the early 2010s was a period of staggering inequality. I mean, America was still, and much of the world, limping back to life after the Great Recession. People were in pain. Most people were being, left out of what we kind of quaintly call the American dream still, even though it exists more in other countries than in America. And here were all these wealthy, powerful people, entrepreneurs, people from big companies, big Facebook, big finance, gathering to celebrate the idea that they are the ones going to change the world. And with every passing year in this, it actually started to seem to me that the very people gathering in Aspen to talk about changing the world were the people who, when they were not in Aspen, were causing the problems they were flying to Aspen to solve. They were prosecuting big finance in ways that led to the kind of crisis that knocked millions of people off their feet in the financial crisis. They were prosecuting the kind of big tech revolution that has allowed the Cambridge Analytica stuff to happen here, that allowed Facebook to basically compromise American democracy and possibly tip a federal election result. They were producing monopolies like Amazon that basically lead to a world in which there's no stores anymore, and we all have to buy everything from one place that owns everything. And then they were flying to Aspen and not only talking about giving back, thereby scrubbing their reputation, but actually taking charge rhetorically and actually of social change, running organizations, putting themselves on the boards. You do a donation, you're now in charge. Deciding how our public schools should be. Reshaping the conversation around how we empower women so that we kind of stop talking about maternity leave and social policy and rights, and we start talking about lean in, which is basically, I think, telling women to make sexism their problem by raising their hand higher, as though sexism were like a posture problem. But this is what happens when a billionaire becomes in charge of the conversation about feminism, for example. And that example that we may laugh at on Lean In is, I think, a microcosm of what I saw happening across that space, but also just across a lot of the world, which is when the rich and powerful involve themselves and take leadership of change, they change change. They change the conversation we have about change. They change the kind of changes that are acceptable. And I began to realize I was part of what felt like this kind of sweet-lipped lie. And so, sorry, long answer to your question. When I was asked to give a speech, I was actually asked to give a speech about a previous book I'd written about a hate crime. I said yes, and I decided to commit a bit of a crime by giving a speech about something else entirely without really telling them. And I decided to speak to this room of a few hundred people who were in this kind of philanthrocapitalist complex and say, well, I think you guys are fighting on two sides of a war. And I think what you do by operational daylight often impacts the world negatively in ways that what you do by philanthropic moonlight can never compensate for. There is no philanthropy Mark Zuckerberg can do in his young, in the many decades he has ahead of him that will undo what he did to American democracy. Simply because of the scale of what happens when you undermine a democracy of a country as large and powerful as the United States, what philanthropy could have an effect that dwarfs the effect possibly of making Donald Trump president? Right? What philanthropy can Goldman Sachs do that will repay all those people who lost their homes, their jobs, their marriages, in some cases their lives as a consequence of second and third order effects? Because of reckless speculation, the financial crisis, for which no one went to jail. No one. And so I decided to speak my truth to that group. And it was a very complicated moment. Some people, to my surprise, gave me a standing ovation. Other people sat on their hands looking angry. And some people did something where their face looked angry, but they gave me a standing ovation. And then later at the bar, the whole thing was captured, the response was captured by a private equity man who came up to me, and he put his hand out, shake my hand, and he says, "You're an asshole." Which may be the first time that word has been said in front of these paintings.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly not the last. It's fascinating. And it seems to me that what you're alluding to here is that these elites have created, if you like, a phony consensus or a status quo about what change looks like that is somehow at odds to what change actually looks like on the ground. And in the book, which I read the book I read the book on Boxing Day, actually, with my leftover turkey, and it was a great afternoon, actually. I had a great time.
I always wonder what people do on Boxing Day. Now,
yeah,
I know.
Well, read Winners Take All, yeah. New York Times best-selling book. And you have this lovely phrase in the book where this collection of elites are quote, guided by the light, by light facsimiles of change, which I think is absolutely right. And I guess I wanted to find out what you thought is motivating them here. You know, is it just that they want to make more money? Is it that they're deluded about the effect that they have? Is it that they simply don't know how else to get involved in the world? What is the motivation here?
You know, I begin the book with a quote from Tolstoy, which is always a strong move, instead of starting with your own paltry words. And he says something to the effect of, you know, I stand on a man's back, choking him, asking him to carry me, and I think to help him in any way I can, except by getting off his back. And I think the position of many of the winners of our age, of the last 30, 40 years, this period of time that is somewhat unique in being a period defined by hyper-technology change, hyper kind of globalization change, also, you know, sort of coincidentally to those things, not really related, but equally cataclysmic in many places, demographic change. I mean, if you think about for a moment, in the last 30, 40 years, we've basically done the rise of women, the rise of ethnic minorities and empowerment in many places, the rise of LGBT people, in addition to the digital revolution and globalization. So there are some people who are on the right side of all of those changes, and it's just been, you know, helium balloons. But there's many people who have received all five of those as headwinds, and then there's many of us in between. And the result is that those elites who have been the winners of that period, I think, recognize that we live in an age of inequality. Recognize, yesterday I was lucky enough to be in the House of Commons during the vote and listen to every MP, regardless of how they voted, telling a 3-minute story about what was actually going on in their constituency, regardless of how they ended up. Those stories were all stories of ache, of jobs lost, of uncertainty, of people unable to see a future that they can run into. And I think the winners of our age, knowing that that's happening, knowing the inequality data, knowing from Oxfam that 82% of new wealth generated in 2017 went to the global 1%, which means that we're not only not fixing historical legacies, we're literally making it worse now. Knowing all of that, have been determined to help, to change, to make a difference. That's why you see every bank's got an impact investment fund. Every rich guy is doing a giving pledge financial thing, you know, giving away lots of money, philanthropic thing. Every, you know, Silicon Valley business claims it's a humanitarian project. You know, every ice cream company is like giving back 3% of your, you know, chocolate chips. And yet, what I think in general the winners of our age are unwilling to do is get off the man's back. So they're willing to do anything and everything, like the things I described. But they're not willing. So what would getting off the back be? They're not willing to pay higher taxes or just stop avoiding them. They're not willing to let go of their double Dutch with an Irish sandwich tax maneuver they all use. They're not willing to pay people more to do their jobs. They're not willing to stop lobbying against austerity and the kinds of public policies that we know are going to hurt people but benefit financial elites. They're not willing to actually commit to the communities that have made them as companies and which they can now effortlessly abandon by sourcing here and selling there. And I think the conversation that I have been trying to force with this book is, what does it look like to imagine the kind of change that would involve the winners of our age stepping off that guy's back, or being made to step off that guy's back?
Yeah, and the language, and what's ironic about what you've just said is the winners of our age, in your vernacular, are taking more and more from the common stock, from the Commonwealth. And yet the language they use to describe their action is the language of win-win. So you outline all of these investments, and this is quite a difficult conversation for a social change-making organization that has many, you know, we have many projects and have had many projects over the last few years that have looked at some of these movements like impact investment, philanthrocapitalism, venture philanthropy, where the language of change is couched in this non-radical, non-confrontational, what's good for me is good for my neighbor. If I do well, it means I can do some good thereby. And your argument, it seems to me, is that's an incredibly corrosive way of looking at the world.
It is so beautifully seductive. So I'm going to ask you, with no embarrassment, how many of you have used the phrase win-win unironically in the last year? Look around for a second. Keep your hands up. Now, what could be wrong? I mean, win-win sounds so great, right? Because it's like taking one victory and then just doubling it. And you don't have to be a math major to know that that's, you know, two is better than one. What could be wrong with doing well by doing good? What could be wrong with all these kind of philanthrocapitalism, you know, double bottom line, triple bottom line? I have a one-year-old. She also has a triple bottom line. and I think what I discovered as I started reporting the book, you know, because the book, I mean, hopefully you don't start a book knowing what you think. I went on a journey of reporting and spent time in these worlds, interviewing people, understanding the rich and powerful in our age as they seek to do good but refuse to get off the man's back and engaging with them. I mean, that's the kind of work that I do. And one of the things I learned was a lot of this is, as you say, couched in this language of win-win. And I couldn't quite figure out what was the problem with it. And obviously, many of you can't either because you've used it unironically, and it seems good. And as I thought about it, it seemed to me what the win-win does is it takes a situation, a concept that's actually derived from the world of trade. Like, you have ice cream, I have money, I want ice cream, you want money, and we do a deal. And in that narrow case, that actually is a win-win. That's exchange, that's market exchange. That's correct use of win-win. What has happened is that this concept of the win-win has been kind of jammed into the sphere of social change and making the world better and actually solving our biggest public problems where it has no business. Okay? So an ice cream trade is an actual win-win situation. Thinking about, like, so to go back to the Sheryl Sandberg example, feminism is not a win-win problem. A lot of men are going to have to lose a lot of power and privilege and the right to grope people at the office and have positions that their mediocrity did not actually entitle them to for that revolution to succeed. The right thing to do, I mean, by the way, it's like maternity leave is expensive. It's actually expensive. Either we pay for it as a society or but someone's going to pay for it and it's expensive. It's worth it, but it's expensive. When everything is couched as a win-win, what you are really saying is that the kinds of social change that actually cost the winners something are ruled out. What you're really saying is the best kind of solutions don't ask anybody to get off anybody's back. What you're really saying is, yeah, tell women the problem is their posture. They should lean forward and raise their hand more. That way we don't have to actually pay them equally, because that would hurt shareholder value. What you're really saying is, yeah, let's have charter schools and, you know, let's have Mark Zuckerberg give some money to a school. Because what you really don't want to do in the United States, I know this is alien here, is end the unbelievably barbaric system we have of funding public education by your local property taxes. So basically, the nicer your house, the better the education you get in America, which is obviously crazy. We don't want to end that. And so what do? We offer, if you just say, well, I'm not touching the education system, you're going to lose your next election or you're going to have a pitchfork in your stomach. So what the winners of our age do is get out in front of it by saying, no, I recognize the desire for more equity in education system. Let's do charter schools. Let's do lean in. Let's not do higher taxes for public education, but let's do this new thing that they're promoting in Silicon Valley, where Silicon Valley companies pay for you to go to college, and then you pay them a percentage of your income, which used to be called taxation. but is now done as an app only for the luckiest students with the highest likelihood of repayment. And so I believe that this win-win thing, although it sounds so good, is actually part of the privatization of the solution of public problems. I don't think all problems need to be solved by the public. I hope my phones continue to be built by the private sector. I hope my airplanes continue to be built by the private sector. I think, frankly, most things that occur in this society or any society in the modern world will be privately built and arranged. But when you look at a problem like social mobility, like the empowerment of women, like what trade has done to communities in this country and the anger that it has aroused, those are the kinds of problems that cannot be solved by really clever businesses or really fun apps or rich people who happen to be feeling generous on a particular day. Those are the kind of problems we can only solve together. And those kinds of solutions have been discredited by the fantasy of the win-win that allows the winners to keep standing on people's backs.
And I think it seems to me that what you're alluding to there is the idea that across the social change space, there's been almost a mass financialization, an incursion of financial norms, of mores. And you have a term for this in the book, market world, that we are living, or some of us anyway, the win-winners, if you like, the elites are living in a market world paradigm, a way of thinking about the world that brooks no other way of thinking about change other than the rules, the norms, the measurements of the market. And it seems to me that, you know, the journey you've taken takes you, in sort of unpicking the four corners of market world, it takes you right across the public space. It takes you from kind of TED Talk evangelists who have one solution that they preach with rare sort of passion to, the Goldman Sachs McKinsey complex, who remain very influential at the heart of American government. Of the various journeys that you took through market world, which seemed to you to be the most absurd, pernicious, ridiculous?
That's a good question. You know, I think of market world, which, by the way, since you're only listening to this, is like one word, capital M, capital W. You visualize it. You know, it's sometimes useful to coin something that describes a complex of things. This book is not about philanthropy, I actually tried to assemble many different things that I think are part of the same cultural tendency. Philanthropy is one of them. Win-win businesses are different from philanthropy, but they're another. The kind of TED Talk circuit where people pay $10,000 to sit in an audience and hear ideas that don't tell them that there's anything wrong with what they do in the world is another part of the enabling of that market world circuit. Fourth thing is the people, as you say, from Goldman Sachs, and the idea that in the nonprofit world or the anti-poverty world that you need to have trained at Goldman Sachs or McKinsey to really understand and be able to help poor people, thereby rebranding arsonists as firefighters. This takes a second, right? All of those things kind of go together. And so, yeah, as you say, I went on a journey. I mean, so one part of the journey is I went to the final Clinton Global Initiative, which is Bill Clinton's big plutocratic Save the World confab that he had every year. And he ended it in 2016. September 2016 was the last one during UN Week in New York. And what was so significant about that moment, as you'll appreciate, is it was, 3 months after Brexit, and 2 months before Hillary lost. And Sadiq Khan was there on stage with President Clinton. So everybody in the room was like processing Brexit, which was kind of the first thing that year that made everybody in that room realize they had no idea what was going on. And then they were 2 months away from again realizing that they had no idea what was going on, although they didn't learn anything between June and November. But it must have been what it was like to be in Marie Antoinette's makeup room right before the revolution, right? It's just like, no, things are going to be fine, right? I mean, there was a little blip. Things are going to be fine. Things were not fine. So after that, in a kind of redrafting of the book, this is a long way to get to it, but I wrote a version of the book, and it didn't quite work. And we didn't know why. And a friend of mine finally diagnosed it. And he said, you got to find the love in this book. You got to find the love in it. And it's obviously a critical book. I mean, it has the word charade in the subtitle. But and I went back and I read the whole book trying to find the love in it, which is to say, it doesn't mean it's not fierce, but to actually engage with people who I was critiquing and understand. So instead of just writing about my CGI, 4 days at CGI as a fly on the wall, I said I should try to interview Bill Clinton about his journey, because no one better captures actually the arc that I'm describing in the book, which I think would be familiar from this country's politics also. The arc from, in 1964, when Bill Clinton was a college student at Georgetown, I don't think you could find anybody who believed more than him that the way you change the world is politics, is movements, is political life. Lyndon Johnson was his hero. Big government, liberalism, solving problems, civil rights, etc. Fast forward 50-some years, I don't think you could find anybody in the world who believed more than Bill Clinton did in what is now the reigning theory of change, which is you make change by getting a bunch of rich people in a room and having the Rockefeller Foundation partner with McDonald's and Goldman Sachs to help 30 fat kids in some neighborhood, that those companies helped be in that situation. And so I sat down with, I requested this interview, and we had like an hour conversation, 90-minute conversation. And Bill Clinton said some things that were just so staggering to me. They're, you know, it's in the book, where he said, you know, it's always better if you can solve problems in the private sector. Why, you know, kind of why bother government? And he had said this line in his speech that I asked him about, which is, you know, this kind of plutocratic private public thing. He said, this is all that works in the modern world. And I thought, for a man who commanded the most powerful machinery of state in the history of human civilization, to think that only by getting like Goldman Sachs and the Rockefeller Foundation together can you solve problems? It just is so manifestly untrue. And so we got an argument about, let's take a particular case, that an issue that he had worked on, which is this childhood obesity issue. Now, a big part of the problem in the US, I don't know if it's the same degree here, is you have these beverage companies, Coke and Pepsi, and whatever, that use their political connections and lobbying to get vending machines into public schools. Our schools, right? These. So I constructed this case because, and he's worked on this issue, but he worked on it by getting Pepsi and Coke to make smaller cans. And he said, you know, well, you have to work with them because you have to, you know, if you get rid of this, they have to still have a business model. And I remember thinking, why is it your problem that they still have to have a business model? They're doing something, they're shortening children's lives. Why do you be solicitous of their needs? So we had this argument, and it just seemed to me such a clear-cut case of, like, it's children, they can't vote, they can't sue, they literally have no recourse to these powerful companies putting these products in their schools. It is public schools, we own the schools, we own the real estate, so the companies have no right to be there. It's not a market transaction. And still you can't just say, I'm the former president of the United States, I'm going to lead a movement, a citizen's movement, using my power and popularity, which he has a lot of, to say no Pepsi or Coke vending machine in any public school in America. You could get that done, couldn't you? I said, no, but you gotta work with the private sector because they have to innovate so that they have a business model. And I just picked that example because it struck me as such a compelling and sad tale. If even he, who knows the power of the law, who knows what movements and politics can do, if even he has capitulated to this view, then his generation of change makers, I think, needs to yield to a younger generation that is coming up, and we are seeing come up, that actually believes what he believed a long time ago, which is that the way you change the world is from below, through movements and politics and the law.
So that's really interesting. Market world as a concept, I mean, you say this explicitly in the book, actually. It aligns broadly with the critique that many give of society, which is this idea of neoliberalism. Market world is, if you will, its material manifestation in our world. And when I think about sort of the economic origins of neoliberalism, Alexander Rousteau, who is writing in the early 20th century, he defined neoliberalism, I think the seminal definition was unfettered markets underpinned by all-intrusive states. And it seems to me that what you're alluding to there is that there's been a degree of collusion on the part of government in the current status quo. Would you agree with that?
I think collusion is a little bit off to me, just because I think it's more of a capture. You know, I think things, again, I try to speak only to the American system in depth because I just don't know other systems. And I think
there's been a bit of capture in Britain as well.
Right, but I think your lobby, I mean, someone was telling me today it takes £75,000 to run for Parliament here, and I was thinking, wow, that's really not a lot of money. I mean, it takes about a few million dollars to run for like the merest congressional seat in the U.S. and $1 billion to run for president. So I think we have some much worse problems in terms of money in politics, but capture takes many forms. Lobbying is capture. Campaign contributions are capture. But also, like, there's a lot of capture of our politics through the intellectual sphere, right? And that's why the win-win thing is so important. One of my notions is that a lot of how the kind of cruelties of this neoliberal period have been perpetrated is through something as simple as language, right? I mean, it's not... Power is not only exerted through, you know, through tanks and bank vaults. I mean, power is often exerted through just distorting people's sense of the possible. And language does a lot there. I think what has happened is government has been captured, and government has failed. Let's be clear. I mean, the argument in my book is that we need to go back to this political sphere, broadly defined, not just government, but the whole political sphere, public sphere, as the place we go to really change the world. But I have no illusions about the fact that the public sphere as it is right now is disappointing. I was in the House of Commons last night, and with all respect to your leaders, although I'm sure many of you would agree with what I'm about to say, watching the Prime Minister and the opposition leader then, on a night that was, you know, one of the most kind of pregnant nights in the history of politics in this country in recent times. Honestly, it felt like watching a competition of two people each trying to be the more uninspiring figure from the 1970s. Like, who could be the more uninspiring 1970s person? I knew I was going to be trouble ever since I sat on Prince Philip's chair. This is why I only get invited places once. It just seemed to me, I was really moved by all the MP speeches. Not the part where they, you know, explain their vote, but the part where they just gave the anthropology of their constituency, what was happening. That information, that's what this whole representative democracy thing is for, just actually revealing that information up to us. And it struck me that if you took a collage of all the different things that were being said by people from all the different parties, it was a collage of pain and fear. And some of that fear leads people to vote for Corbyn, and some of that fear leads people to want to get out of the EU. But forget that for a second. It was just this collage of like people who feel that this place doesn't work for them. They don't know how to operate their lives, that they're unsure of what they're going to be able to give to their children. Just basic human things that we should all have empathy for, regardless of where you go. And it just honestly struck me listening to those two as the choices, as the kind of depositories where all this feeling could go, as just being like really inadequate to all that sentiment. And you could imagine, on the other hand, a charismatic person who could speak to that moment, speak to the pain in this country, speak of the experiences people have, lead it in a hopeful way to what a vision, whether it's in Europe or out of Europe, but just you could imagine something that was inspiring and, you know, we will fight on the beaches, but for this situation. And it was so lacking. And so I think I don't want to let politics off the hook. I am advocating for us solving more of our problems in politics. But politics has to get a lot better and win people back and convince young people in particular that the dogma they've been sold that if you want to make the world better, start an ice cream company that gives back 5%. That's clearly wrong and has been the dogma of our time. But I think we need to convince those young people that politics is a more exciting way to make the world better. And politics is running for office, but it's also creating the conditions for a better politics, which means working in journalism, which means working in think tanks, which means community organizing, which means actually, you know, doing the kind of work that is now growing in the U.S. I don't know if it's happening here also, where you have organizations like the ARENA in the U.S. is one that does like candidate training and recruitment. So you actually proactively go out and recruit people to run for office who are from backgrounds where they might not otherwise. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is a star young congresswoman in the U.S., was recruited by this group called Justice Democrats, who saw her as a mere organizer for Bernie Sanders among thousands of organizers for Bernie Sanders, saw her talents, asked her to run for office, helped her, supported her, and now this one woman's basically changing the Democratic Party through a Twitter account. So change takes a long time, but when it happens, it actually happens pretty quickly. And you know, there are now suggestions that every presidential candidate, and there's going to be like 30 on the Democratic side in the U.S. in this coming election, is basically being asked out of the gate, do you agree with AOC on this? Do you agree with AOC on this? Like, one person recruited to run by one fringe movement is now kind of the head of the fish of this entire party that for 30 years has totally been captured by neoliberal dogma. So it can happen.
I have a bunch of other questions that I want to ask you, but I think it's I've been hogging you for far too long.
Do the people in the paintings get to ask questions?
Well, we'll see. So what I'd like to do now is I'd like to open it out to your questions. There are some roving mics. What I'll do is I'll take three at a time. If you could just say your name and then make your point or ask your question. So we've got gentleman in the front here, we've got lady over there at the back, and we've got gentleman over there. Back.
Hi, I'm David Wood, a fellow of the Society. What's going to prevent the likes of AOC that you mentioned in admiring terms going the same route of Bill Clinton in the future? What's going to allow the inspiring political trends that you admire to succeed rather than being captured?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think the simple answer there is that, and this may be very specific to US politics, but a lot of this depends on where your money comes from. And Bill Clinton was, you know, born poor, one of the poorest people to ever become president. However, his path into office was really shaped by a group called the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, which was essentially, I mean, quite similar to what happened here with Labor under Blair, but was kind of a group that pushed for a more corporate version of the Democratic Party away from being a trade union party towards being a more corporate, you know, I sometimes joke, but it's sort of true, that the distinction now between the American parties is like there's kind of a party of money that hates gay people and a party of money that doesn't hate gay people, you know. There's like a white party of money and there's like a diverse party of money. There's like two different parties of money. And so Bill Clinton's money delimited his possibilities. So one of the things that Ocasio has done, now maybe she changes her mind, I don't know, but I doubt it. She's committed to only small dollar contributions. And she's put her time where her mouth is. So for example, one of the little known things that actually not a lot of people knew about in the US until she exposed it recently was that all these members of Congress spend much of their day doing call time, which is sitting in their office calling donors. Well, it's actually ridiculous that that's even allowed, but that's what they do. Well, she announced that she won't be doing call time. You can send her a small donation to this website. That's it. Well, that's pretty interesting. And that means that Goldman Sachs, when they want a meeting with her, she has no obligation to give them a meeting. Whereas you look at Obama and Clinton, and I think Obama is incorruptible compared to Bill Clinton, but was even he was swept up in, I mean, Obama's top donor was Goldman Sachs, right? I don't think he's not personally profiting from it, but I think it shapes a worldview. He hired a lot of Goldman Sachs people, you know. So I think a lot of who your friends are, who you party with, and where you get your money shape a lot of your outlook. And actually having those sources change and having the kinds of movements, I mean, the organization that really catapulted AOC is called Justice Democrats. I would look at them. I mean, they're a small outfit. It's had a pretty great bang for its buck in terms of changing the nation's conversation with, I don't think they spent more than a few million dollars, while other people spent billions achieving nothing.
There's a lady over there.
Hi, Catherine Nelson. Thanks for a great talk. I'm looking forward to reading your book. Do you think we need a new cultural narrative? Is it the fact that taxation and some of these things which contribute to the public space have been, over the last 30, 40 years, devalued, knocked, been something that people don't see the benefits from? And do we need someone to stand up and speak for them in the same way as people need to speak up for Europe?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's actually, to my mind, as an outsider, very analogous to the Europe thing, which is, I think sometimes there's this problem of things that are good, that we feel are good, are noble, we don't feel the need to sell to people. I mean, Europe to me is like such an amazing example of this. Like, it certainly, you know, however you feel about it, I think it's inarguable that the EU has probably saved more lives, if you just look at the trajectory, like saved more lives than maybe any innovation in the history of the world. And I think it deserved the Nobel Prize. And yet, there was always a smugness to the EU of like something that didn't need to make people love it and didn't need to make people feel citizenship. I mean, I've never met anybody who like felt like a citizen of the EU more than they felt as like a citizen of somewhere else. Well, it didn't have to be that way. I mean, it felt like inevitable, but it wasn't inevitable. I mean, the United States, people used to once feel more loyal to their states than the country. That changed, and now it may be changing back in reverse. But I think that was a real failure. And I always felt that, you know, that it, as an outsider, it always seemed to me there was a smugness to like, this project is good, it's self-evidently good, and it didn't need to be sold. Well, it turns out it really did need to be sold, and actually no one loved it. Everyone knew it was important, but no one loved it. And I think government is sort of like that in general. You know, like you can't, I met someone from the cabinet office this morning, I was saying, you know, we don't give government, any problem that government decisively solves once and for all goes into a bucket of things we no longer feel grateful for. This is the problem with government, right? Like, if you eat in a restaurant in this country, the chances of you getting sick are basically zero. There's some, you know, occasionally. But when was the last time you got food poisoning in a restaurant? Now, you all know that when you go to many countries in the world, even countries that have great universities and this and that, you get sick almost every time you eat out in a restaurant. There are many places like that. Well, it is a massive civilizational accomplishment that may be boring, but is actually not, to have created a country where like you can't get sick when you eat out. Just, and I'm picking one little thing. But the roads, driving, air travel, these are all miracles. And they're miracles that were enabled by public systems and infrastructure that we built that just hums along. Like, do you understand how amazing it is that you can just fly from one country to, do you understand what went into that? And it wasn't just building an airplane. The coordination, all of that. What the courts do. Do you understand, like, the amount of infrastructure that allows one person to have a business in this country? The number of things that are working right just so you can have your business and have electricity and the internet, and if someone steals your, you know, supplies, you can take them to court. Like, and we don't appreciate any of that because it's just in the bucket of things we're not grateful for anymore because it's solved. So I think part of it is, as with Europe, a storytelling challenge of like making people appreciate government. Making people appreciate, I mean, you see all these gripes about the NHS, but you had this counter movement recently on social media, like people telling NHS stories. And it was very moving because it's just so easy to forget how important government is. And I think we're ripe for a new story of, like, screw the narrative of like Mark Zuckerberg is a hero. I'm not sure what kind of hero ruins everything. you know, we need to tell the story of how we built these societies that are actually little miracles or big miracles, and have young people see themselves in roles of upkeep of these amazing projects, and not have them feel like homework.
There was a gentleman over there, I think. If you speak into the microphone.
My name is Andy Hicks. When you said about the House of Commons, and if only there was a charismatic leader, it automatically made me think of Obama, and I'm interested to know more about what you thought of his presidency. You know, his tagline, very similar to your title, change you can believe in, and yet he gave birth to Trump in some way. So interested, and also there was a huge grassroots movement in getting him elected, I think both times. So I'm interested to know more about what you think about his presidency in relation to really changing the world.
Look, I will say, I think Barack Obama is probably one of the best human beings to ever govern any country in the world. Probably one of the best, most intelligent people to ever govern any place anywhere in the world. I think he transformed the idea of who could have power through that kind of grassroots stuff. He also had some very serious handicaps. Number one, he took over right in the moment of a kind of Great Depression light. Number two, he was a black man in a country that does not allow black men the kind of same right of anger and of using the kind of language that FDR used during the Great Depression of malefactors of wealth. I mean, if Barack Obama had gone after the people who caused the financial crisis, as I think he should have, with the same language that FDR did, as a white aristocrat from New York versus an African-American president, I think Barack Obama would have had even bigger problems than he did. So I think he was limited because of our racial politics in his ability to speak certain truths about our time. That said, I think he is also temperamentally one of the most conservative people. Just that's who he is. Aside from the race stuff and the context, he's not a flamethrower. I also don't think you become the first black president of the United States of America if you're a flamethrower. So I don't think it's a surprise that it was him and not Jesse Jackson, right? But he's just not, like, Barack Obama is the most 1950s family you could have, right? Not for many people, but actually, you know, and so I just think his heart is in the right place. He had amazing political gifts, but when it came to redistributing power and actually going after Wall Street or kind of advocating real shifts in who kind of monopolized progress and breaking up those monopolies, I just think it isn't who he is, and he was handicapped in his ability to do so. And so I think what he did was, I mean, the healthcare thing, like, I'm on Obamacare. It's okay. It's good. I mean, it's better than not having health insurance. He made a real difference. That Obamacare stuff did move the needle a little bit on, it certainly moved the needle on the healthcare. It moved the needle on some larger things. But he didn't really arrest the 40-year stagnation. We can't arrest the stagnation. He didn't reverse the 40-year stagnation of average people's fortunes. And, you know, I think he was a limited figure. And if you look at the people around him, I mean, he hired as many Goldman Sachs and McKinsey people as anybody else. And I start the book with actually someone who went to go work for his, well, she was, I start the book with someone who went to work for McKinsey because she was sold on the idea that that was how she was going to learn to change the world. And she's about to leave as soon as she realized, obviously, you don't go to McKinsey to learn how to change the world. And she's about to leave, and she gets a phone call saying, hey, we have a project for you. Barack Obama's about to leave the presidency, and he wants to start a foundation to reinvigorate democracy and restore power to the people, and he wants to hire McKinsey to advise him on how to do so. And part of her thinks, well, that's insane. Why would he call McKinsey to help him reinvigorate democracy? And another part of her thinks, well, if he's calling, maybe I should stay. And so she stayed and she went to work for him. Anyway, I've given you a lot of different perspectives on him. But I just think he's an example of how charismatic people is not enough. You know, if he had had a different movement behind him, if he had had a different base of funders, if he'd had, you know, real citizens' armies out there able to push for something more like the NHS, as opposed to this weird private healthcare thing we have, it could have been very different.
Okay, we're going to go for one more round of questions. If I could ask you to keep it as brief as possible. And what we'll do is we'll take the questions all at once, and then we'll just answer.
Then an algorithm will meld them into one.
Absolutely.
And
I am that algorithm.
Right.
So we had a lady in front here, we had a gentleman in front there, and we had a lady over there.
Angela. Thank you.
If you just speak into the microphone.
Thank you, Angela Harvey. What happened to American antitrust laws?
That's a great question.
My only concern with what you've said is that it points a lot towards the Singapore model, where there is a very transparent trade and constant sharing with people of what the benefit of the state is to the people. They get great security, they get great healthcare, they're expected to contribute in that, but what they're trading for it is obviously a lot of freedoms and true democracy. In other words, it walks against a true democratic model, if you follow some of the direction of what you're saying.
There's a lady over there. Sorry, there's a mic coming your way.
Hi. From a business point of view, first of all, we pay all the tax and we treat our staff very well. I really want to ask you, because as we get more momentum, we're only a business, but we're constantly getting invited to the government and even listening to our conference, and we're really not the expert. We're in a situation where if we want to give money to the charities, we don't know how much you go to executive pays. We don't know how much they're going to really change. And politics, everyone's disillusioned. So it's in, and then as we become more successful, people are willing to listen to our stories, yet we're not any experts. So what's the solution for business really want to give something back?
What's your business?
It's a fashion. So we literally, because for lots of young designers, they have no way to market, and PR is so expensive, so we actually give them all the data, use algorithm. We are actually a tech company to give them for free, and we charge big company money for that.
Interesting. So you've got
antitrust.
What the hell happened to antitrust?
It's a great question. Basically, I mean, it's one of the most urgent questions in the US that would have huge implications to the rest of the world. Well, the simple answer is like we have just neglected to go after these big companies. Facebook, Google, Amazon, I mean, should be broken up immediately. And I went to Google and gave a talk suggesting that they break it into two companies called Goo and Gull. if you've ever seen 40 engineers look terrified, that's what happened to my talk at Google, which you can find online.
Is that online? Yeah.
It's less awkward online. They tried to kill the talk, and then we threatened them, and then they put it online. Because they own YouTube also, because that's how monopolies work. Hey, Google. The more technical answer is that there is actually a problem with the law not being updated. The law basically of monopoly, at least in the US, was focused on whether the power trust concentration results in higher prices for consumers. That was used as the evidence of a monopoly. The problem now is that monopolies have actually resulted, because of how the dynamics of the internet works, in lower prices, or many of these businesses don't charge money. I mean, like Facebook and Google don't charge consumers. So they don't really fit the law, so we basically need new laws. And then we, of course, have not passed a new law in the United States of any note in a long time. So there's a new guy on Capitol Hill, David Cicilline or something, who's apparently, he's just taken over this committee because the Democrats won, and he's apparently been studying antitrust law for the last 2 years. That was a big story today, and is trying to go after them. So I think that's a big, exciting new area. But frankly, it's not just lobbying that they've avoided it. There are actually new questions here. There are, network effects are a new thing. Like, Facebook also kind of wouldn't work if half your friends were on the other one, so we have to figure out, do we just not let them buy Instagram and WhatsApp? How do we actually do it? It's a hard problem that we need really smart people to think about. What I'm saying does not lead to the Singapore model, but that was a nice try. The Singapore model is pre-committed above all to authoritarianism. The rest of it is just add-on. I mean, these societies are free societies, they're gonna remain free societies. And what I am talking about is in existence in pieces in many places in the world. I mean, one of the fantasies in the United States, I don't know if it's a fantasy here, is that if you had a slightly more restrained version of capitalism, you'd basically be living in, you know, the gulags of the 1960s in the Soviet Union. Well, that's just not true. Like, I mean, in the American imagination, at least, like, Germany doesn't exist, because the idea of a place where you actually have quite a few businesses and quite a lot of dynamism and quite high productivity and whatever is also a place where people don't die in the street because they work 29 hours a week at a company and therefore don't get health care instead of 30, right? It's easy to take these choices that many of our societies have made that are actually very weird, extreme, dehumanizing choices and basically say, if we solve them, it's going to be tyranny. It's just not true. That is a, to my mind, a billionaire talking point that has been discredited by the example of various places that have made their lives of their citizens more decent without becoming tyrannies.
And don't forget the million immigrants Germany took
in. Right, correct. Correct. I don't really fully know the answer to your question, but I think what I would say is it is a common complaint that kind of business people have brought in to... part of what has happened is not just that business people push their way into the public sphere, but the public sphere feeling increasingly unconfident, or the NGO sphere, these others, actually feel like the only people who know how to solve anything are business people. And so this is two ways. I mean, I know people who want to go work in social work who are told by social work organizations or NGOs, whatever, that you need to go work at like JP Morgan for a couple of years to get some experience before you come here and help the poor, right? And that's how weird and pervasive this culture has been. And I want to make that clear, because it's not only business people perpetuating this. This is, to your point, a culture. And everybody participates in a culture, right? I think about it sometimes as like capital supremacy, right? And like other supremacies, it is all pervasive. It touches everything, and even those on the wrong end of it end up participating in it and upholding it sometimes in strange ways. And I think the only way to eradicate it is by shifting the power structure through some of the things we've talked about, but also through attacking the culture and telling different stories and telling better stories about how we make things better.
I think that's a wonderful message on which to end, because we are out of time, I'm afraid.
Can I ask them one thing?
Go on, then. One thing.
One thing. I don't live here. I don't know a lot of people here, so you guys are my new friends here. I would appreciate it if you'd let other people know about the book, which is just coming out here now. If you're on Twitter, my pinned tweet is just about the book and where they can find out more about the UK edition. So spread the word if you would, and I'd be very grateful.
I think that's you can take that as read. I think there's so much we didn't cover that's in the book. There's some brilliant passages and chapters on where Anand meets some of the great American philanthropic families and puts to them some of the cognitive dissonances between what they do and some of the philanthropic work they do and some of the things that they're invested in. It's really interesting stuff, so I'd urge you all to read it. It means for me to say thank you all for coming, for your questions. If you didn't get a chance to ask your question, there will be a chance to meet Anand outside. He'll be in the foyer for a bit, signing a few books, hanging out, which is great, thank you. And if you'd like to know more about the RSA and keep up to date with our own efforts to change the world, to really change the world, do sign up via our website for our events and projects newsletters, or head downstairs to our coffee house, Rothmel's, now for lunch or a coffee or a biscuit or a bun, whatever really takes your fancy. You are very likely to bump into a fellow or staff member. I could even be there, you know, lucky. And find out a little bit more about our current work and how you can get involved. For now, please join me once again in thanking our terrific speaker, Anand Giridharadas.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.